We all have palliatives, illusions we rely on, or our treats, sweets to suck on while being masticated by power. I'm not judging that. By definition, we must have them. I'm just asking that we face squarely the mastication and start discussing it out loud. And then there was this column I was drawn to because she, the author, she's writing about division and how language is used to foster it, i.e. for political purposes. But she doesn't say what purposes these might be. And so it seemed to me this column provides a good example of why it's important to have an analysis of division and why it exists if you're going to talk about division, at least if deepening understanding is your goal. This was a column in the Chronicle of January 12th, 2013 by Kaylee Milner. It's entitled Creepily Creative with Word Creative. She starts by describing a couple conversations she had with folks who called themselves creatives. One was at a party. He used the term and she probed what he meant and discovered that he was a financial analyst, specifically a quant. Quote, now I'm quoting the article, that means he was one of the people who does statistical arbitrage of the kind that was in no small way responsible for the 2008 financial crisis. Somehow he'd managed to redefine this profession, at least to himself, as one of the creative ones, probably inspired by the economist Richard Florida's popular and disingenuous idea that there is a creative class of people who drive economic development in cities like, well, San Francisco, unquote. And then after that conversation, she overheard folks talking in a coffee shop and was kind of irritated by their arrogance and said, okay, so what are you guys doing exactly? And she was told that they were creatives. Are you? I asked, she writes. What is that? And so she found out that in their case, it meant that they were programmers. They did something involving software coding. And then she writes, quote, these episodes left me in despair, and not only because the English language was being abused. Language is the only tool we have to understand the world. And when basic words like creative lose their definition, well, count me in with George Orwell as believing that other things will suffer too. And then she quotes Orwell, the decline of a language must ultimately have political and economic causes, wrote Orwell in Politics and the English Language, also noting that words used vaguely and dishonestly lead to insincerity, slovenly thinking, and in the worst cases, the inability to take positive action. And she goes on by saying, if all that sounds dramatic, consider the absurdity of the two stories I just shared. These are people with jobs that make them plenty of money, certainly far more than most creative people make. There's nothing wrong with making money, but there is something very wrong with believing that you have an elevated calling to remake the world when what you really have is a job with marginal social utility. It allows you to believe that since your work is crucial not only to the functioning of society, but also to people's higher needs and desires, all the world really needs is more people like you, unquote. And I found this article, this column, really interesting. It shows how absent an analysis, even when you come from a place of love, you can end up serving power by feeding division, blaming our brothers and sisters, and reinforcing the story that making money, that phrase that's never unpacked, is a legitimate focus of our existence. So the problem ends up being not these 10,000 would-be philosopher kings who hide behind scenes, but we, all unwitting pawns of their manipulation, her brothers and sisters. Now, I rather liked this essay into false division. But imagine if she put her observations in a context. Imagine if she developed her voice, owned her body, made conscious her allegiance, and noted, therefore, what's going on right now for the species. How critical the juncture. What decisions are to be made. That's what her body wants to do, but the job will not allow it. But you can feel it in her words, her longing for solidarity. Imagine when we take a stand for each other, shake off power, and begin working on the problems together. But absent a larger context and a larger analysis, her message boils down to a request for more humility, which could easily be fit into Power's strategy to get us to leave to them the shaping of the globe hierarchically. All roads lead back to Power until we intervene consciously and build roads leading to solidarity, to our, all of us, taking responsibility for redesigning our social possibilities. In Revealing Division, I wrote that Power commandeering the language for propagandistic purposes renders it effectively meaningless. But I meant for us. But as propaganda, it has a meaning. It means we've been conquered. As language has been far from how we understand the world, it's been our most precious invention for claiming it. But the manipulation of these young people that she notes is interesting. In Revealing Division, I also quote Popper's description of Plato's contribution to Power's art of manipulation. Popper wrote, and this was describing Plato's propagandistic strategy, quote from Popper, "To tell men they are equal has a certain sentimental appeal, but this appeal is small compared with that made by a propaganda that tells them that they are superior to others and that others are inferior to them. Are you naturally equal to your servants, to your slaves, to the manual worker who's no better than an animal? The very question is ridiculous." Plato seems to have been the first to appreciate the possibilities of this reaction and to oppose contempt, scorn, and ridicule to the claim to natural equality. In the Laws, Plato summarized his reply to equalitarianism with the formula, quote, "equal treatment of unequals must beget inequity," unquote. And this was developed by Aristotle into the formula, quote, "equality for equals, inequality for unequals," unquote.